and welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly, the podcast determined to bring tech-based light to your dark evenings and provide an umbrella of knowledge to shield you from those unpleasant autumn showers. This week, we'll be finding out just how it's possible to manufacture a $12 computer, and I'll be breaking my vow never to discuss sports as we find out what's new in the world of football management.
In the beginning, you were nobody. Who are you? The fans cry. You're in over your head, the papers say. But you don't listen. Now it's your team's colours filling the air. And it's you holding the cup.
Who are you indeed? My name's Susie Weezer, and joining me this week is the delectable Bobby Johnson and the delightful Charles Arthur. Now, thanks to Saturday's Guardian's Guide to the Night, I found out that in ye olden days, we all enjoyed 2 hours of sleep per night. One from 9 to midnight, and then a second from 2 a.m. till the morning. Bobby, as someone who's just woken up whilst the rest of us are finishing a day's work, would you say you're an 8 hour straight sleeping beauty?
No, not at all. I tend to kind of take several shifts of sleeping. Go to bed very late, get up early, and then maybe have a nap later on. I'm interested though, because I haven't read this. What did people do between midnight and 2 a.m?
Funny you should say that. They had a snack. They might have caught up on some reading, or they might have done other things that you do in the bedroom.
Oh, okay. Charles, what about you?
First rule of cross-examination, never ask a question you don't know the answer to.
Charles, what about you? Any strange sleeping patterns? Brushing lightly over that?
Well, no, I tend to stay up very late, but I can get up very early.
So, with our team assembled on the pitch, it's time to kick off on this week's Guardian Tech Weekly. Consider the whistle officially blown. Now, while some of us are sleeping, there are others who are trying to use their powers for good, such as in the case of Derek Lomas. He heads up a team that develops educational games for use by kids in the developing world, based on a $12 8-bit computer. Bobby, you spoke to Derek at the PopTech conference, which brings together the great and the good to discuss the social impact of new technologies. What's the idea behind his PlayPower project?
You remember the old, you know, the BBC Micro and the Commodore 64 and that whole generation of 8-bit computers. Well, now we're a good 25 years after those hit the market, and the patents have expired effectively on the chipsets that are inside. So a lot of manufacturers, particularly Chinese manufacturers, are now making these machines incredibly cheaply because there's no intellectual property cost. They don't have to license anything from anybody. They're making these computers really cheaply, selling them in developing markets like India, China, Brazil, other places, and you can go out and buy one for maybe $10 or $12 or the equivalent. So what Derek's doing is trying to harness that and use the same kind of things that a lot of us learned in the 80s with those original computers, trying to bring those skills to the people who are buying it in the developing countries. So when I met up with him at PopTech, I asked him about it and started off by trying to find out what exactly they're trying to do with this.
Many people in my generation grew up with 8-bit typing games and math games, adventure games, things like that. We sort of have this idea that even some basic computer skills like touch typing can be economically transformative, making the difference between earning $1 a day as an urban laborer or $1 an hour as a back office worker. So what we're trying to do is obtain some of this abandoned 8-bit software that was produced in the 80s for education in England and America and port it to this existing $12 computer. We're also developing our own games as well and a programming environment so that people in India, Brazil, China, etc. are able to create new games on a platform that's affordable.
On the flip side of what you're doing, there's projects like One Laptop Per Child who are trying to develop new things for developing markets. Is there a tension between those two ideas, or do they work in concert with each other?
Yeah, I don't think that there's much tension because the heart of what we're doing is content. We're not trying to develop new hardware. We're not trying to develop new hardware systems or distribution channels. We're trying to make use of existing manufacturing and existing distribution networks, and we're just trying to acquire and develop good content. We're not just based on this platform either. We'd be interested in developing on any low-cost platform. We're hoping to just act as a sort of open source community network resource that would be able to inject effective educational games onto any low-cost platform, including mobile phones.
How are you working with the manufacturers of these systems? Because, like you said, you know, they're selling it for games. They're not selling it for this other stuff. How do they appreciate it?
They are selling it for education. On the cover of all the boxes that are sold, it says education computer. So there is something about their marketing that is appealing to parents, probably because they're the ones buying the computers. So they recognize that having an educational impact is valuable for selling their product, but that's about as far as their engagement goes. They don't have the margins to invest in research and development of effective learning games, but they are interested in them. So when we contacted some of these manufacturers, one question they had was whether we had any content in Arabic, because they're getting a lot of Middle Eastern buyers, and so we might be able to provide them with some learning games for the different regions that they sell to. Education is traditionally an area that we have a fairly common political philosophy about, which is that the market does lots of things really, really well, but education is one of those core areas that we believe isn't supported by the market alone. We believe that we should all be working together, governments, nonprofits, volunteers, designers, developers, and for-profit companies, to be producing a sort of digital, open-source educational curriculum that can be brought to areas of the world that have a lot of educational problems. Technology has so much potential because it can be scaled at such low cost and so rapidly and so cheaply that it really seems to hold a lot of potential.
I don't necessarily feel this way myself, but I can imagine people looking at this and saying, these are machines and this is technologies that the West was using 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Isn't it a bit patronising to say, hey, you guys, you can have what we did years ago? When a lot of developing countries want to leapfrog, we're building them to be call centre employees rather than the new generation of, you know, very high-tech engineers or something.
We're not forcing people to buy these machines. They're already buying them. They're largely not using these as a tool. This isn't something for word processing. And tools become obsolete in a way that content doesn't. A scythe can be made obsolete very quickly by a more effective tool. But poems are not made obsolete by the emergence of the novel. And similarly, educational content, games, 8-bit games, Mario Brothers is not obsolete because there's a new version of Mario Brothers. You play the first one and it's still really fun. But at the same time, I completely agree. Technology moves very quickly, and we expect that computers that cost as low as $12 will continue to exist, but will become more and more powerful with time.
What might have to change about the software? I mean, there's a lot of cultural context in a lot of games. You know, some of the information's no longer accurate or whatever. You know, things change. How much of the software can you simply grab and stick onto one of these machines, and how much will you need to tweak it?
Yeah, well, an obvious example is translation. There'd be a lot of good reasons to translate some of the language that's used in the software. Similarly, something like Oregon Trail, which is a game about America's westward expansion, was a very popular game in the States and educational, but probably doesn't have that much cultural relevance for, you know, people in Africa or India. It might be interesting, but
In fairness, it didn't have that much impact in Britain either.
I can imagine.
We didn't play a lot of it.
We don't necessarily want to make claims about what is or what is not relevant in different areas. But if we can make this stuff available for modification and repurposing to allow a conversation of cultures to occur around the digital content, then we think that's how we'd make the most impact.
What kind of skills do you need? Who do you need to get involved, and how could somebody do that?
We've gotten a lot of support from students in university, for instance, because when you're learning something like assembly programming, there's not that many places to apply it, but it's something, when you're making 8-bit games, it's very useful. you know, we're still looking for a good intellectual property lawyer to help us obtain some of this old content. And educators, too. We've got teachers who have lots of ideas for games they use in the classroom. We would love to see greater governmental support in developed nations for supporting digital education, not just our project, but in general. So there's really lots of different ways for lots of different kinds of people to contribute to this project.
That was Bobby there talking to Derek Lomas, who heads up the PlayPower team. Bobby, you've had a go on the console. What were your initial impressions?
I've been transported back to sitting in a classroom after hours, bashing away on a typing game because it was fun. Immediately, you know, that took me back straight away. I think the overall thing is that this is stuff that's already been proven and been out there. So they're not really trying to do anything new. They're just trying to bring it to a new market who don't have access to it, but the material's already there.
Yeah, okay. Charles, what do you think about using an 8-bit system? Is there a risk they're teaching generation of kids out-of-date skills?
I don't think it's that the skills are out of date. I just think that it doesn't matter what, you know, how many bits the computer has. The question is more what sort of software it is that you're providing to people. If it's very closed software, if it's stuff that doesn't encourage the child to create something, to try to explore something, if it doesn't give them an idea of manipulating concepts in the way that, for example, Early Basic did. You know, a lot of people who are, you know, writing games now started up with Early Basic, which was so dead easy to write programs in that pretty much anyone could get into it, and it gave them the idea of algebra, of manipulating, of arrays, lists, all those sorts of things. If the programs like that aren't available, then, you know, it doesn't matter how many bits the computer has. Those are the important things.
Okay, Bobby, what about the conference itself? Did you get a feeling that, you know, lives were really being changed as a result of these people at the conference? Or did you get the feeling it was more a chance for people to get together and talk theoreticals?
I think it was a mixture. I mean, PopTech every year delivers a few very interesting speakers who you maybe haven't heard of, who are doing kind of world-changing things on the sly. What was interesting about Derek and some of the other people that I spoke to, the conference also runs a what they call a social innovations fellowship. And so basically they take some people who are still at quite a nascent stage in developing their ideas, like PlayPower, and they give them some support, give them a platform to talk to the people who are in the audience, who are pretty high profile generally, and, you know, give them a chance to talk about their ideas on a bigger stage. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about PopTech and about what it was like to be there. It was just that here was this group of people who were kind of throwing ideas out there. They're not finished. They're not telling you it's all done and sorted and the world is saved, but they're asking for help.
Okay, so worthwhile conference then, overall, you reckon?
Oh, I certainly got my warm and huggy feeling
good.
From it. I
think. Good. So that's a look at the technology hitting the developing world. And meanwhile, here's Bobby with a look at the latest tech headlines closer to home.
The British government's plans to disconnect alleged file sharers from the internet are continuing to come under fire after Lord Mandelson announced that he aimed to have legislation in place by the summer of 2011. As well as opposition from many users and internet service providers, a study of 1,000 people conducted on behalf of the think tank Demos suggested that those who download illegally spend more money on music than other consumers. Google last week announced its intention to include driving directions and traffic information on its Android handsets, a move that could drastically alter the GPS market and sent shares in satellite navigation companies TomTom and Garmin plunging. Internet administrators ICANN last week confirmed plans to allow web addresses to contain non-Latin characters for the first time. Later this month, the first steps towards international domain names will be made, which could make websites available in scripts such as Cyrillic, Arabic, and in Chinese characters, with the hope that it will broaden the worldwide appeal of the internet. And there were mixed fortunes in the mobile world, as Apple finally launched the iPhone in China, while Nokia announced that it was killing off the N-Gage mobile gaming service. 4 years after it ditched the standalone device in favour of adding the software to many of its smartphones, the Finnish company said it was ending development of all N-Gage games from now on.
Charles, in attempting to stamp out illegal file sharers, is the government attacking the wrong part of the problem? They're not addressing the music industry and their possibly out-of-date business model.
Well, I guess the problem is that the government can't really attack the music industry and tell them to change the way they license stuff. You know, the music industry licenses its tracks as it wants to. But there is certainly a problem, which is that for web based music systems such as Spotify or We7, they can never scale. They can't sort of have the explosive growth of any other sort of organization such as Twitter, for example, where it's about as cheap for Twitter to run 1,000 users as 1,000,000 users, because all you have to do is add a little bit more capacity to the database. For Spotify or for We7, every time you play a track, you have to pay the licensing fee. And the trouble is that the business model prevents that sort of explosion. So the government could sort of press the music industry if they wanted to, but then again, the music industry is just very effective at lobbying them. And so the government is sort of responding to the lobbying.
Okay, so is this Peter Mandelson talking a lot of hot air, or is it realistic to say that this is going to be implemented in summer 2011, which is currently planned?
I think that getting it through the legislative timetable is going to be quite tricky, because the election is coming down the tracks now. It's June 2010, I think, is the latest that it can be. Parliament will be dissolved before then. For this to ping pong back and forth through the Commons and the Lords and so on before it's really implemented and passed into law, always assuming that the Conservatives, if they were to win the next election, would then carry on with it. If the legislation doesn't get through onto the statute books before the election is called, it dies completely. So they'd be starting again. So I've got to say, I wouldn't be putting large amounts of money on this being actually passed into legislation before the election.
I'm sure there'll be a few people relieved about that. Now, what about this Android GPS news? Doom mongers have leapt on the news and predicted the death of the GPS industry. Bobby, is it all over for the likes of TomTom and Garmin, or are we a little premature in predicting something that extreme?
This may be a slightly early call. I mean, definitely the manufacturers of GPS units have been looking out for a long time as phones have got more complex. But, you know, if you're one of the few players in that market, and remember, there aren't hundreds of manufacturers of GPS units like there are hundreds of manufacturers of mobile phones. So the competition's slightly different. I think I'd compare it more to, say, the iPod market and the iPhone or smartphones. People still buy plenty of iPhones because they can leave them in the they can't leave them in the car, but they can leave their GPS unit in the car. I think they're hitting slightly different markets. I think that what you're going to lose is maybe the low end models, where people, you know, it's just easier to plug your phone in and do that than it is to buy a cheap GPS, because you've already got a cheap GPS effectively. So I think maybe we'll see a move to the kind of higher end of the market, perhaps. But I mean, they're certainly worried. This is a long term threat that could end up destroying their businesses completely.
Cheery news. but in essence, people don't need to go chucking out their sat navs just yet, by the sounds of it. Now, finally, last week we discussed Orange's pricing of the iPhone. Now, the update is, sadly for consumers, it seems there's no price war, with very little difference between O2 and Orange's tariffs. Charles, you've done the maths. Can you give us a very brief summary of what we're looking forward to?
Yeah, to say that there's very little difference between them is incredible. When I looked at the numbers on Monday morning, I thought, that's strange. Why has Orange sent me the O2 price plan? It turns out they're not actually exactly the same. There is 2 pence difference between the 18-month price plan, for example, on the cheapest rates. The biggest difference that I could find is if you take the 18-month contract and you're getting an iPhone 3GS 16 gig, for that you have 29.38 if you're with O2, or 29.36 if you're with Orange, and you pay 184.98 if you're with O2, and 184.50 if you're Orange, which is a grand total over the 18 months of 84 pence difference. And that is the largest difference that you'll find between it. The other difference is actually that on that low-end 18-month contract, you get twice as many minutes and text. You get 150 minutes, 250 texts with Orange as compared to 75 and 125 on O2. That is about the only place that you can put a card between them, which I think is just amazing.
Just think what you could do with that 84 pence.
Well, don't spend it all at once because you've got 18 months to think about it.
Now, you can, of course, find out more about all these stories on the Guardian Tech homepage. Just go to guardian.co.uk/tech for more. Now, for those with football-based aspirations with a dash of managerial skills, Football Manager 2009 has been the game, and this time last year, it began its reign of 22 weeks at the top of the charts. This resulted in sales of over 500,000 copies, making it the most popular football management game on the planet. But with the launch of the latest version, the imaginatively titled Football Manager 2010, Tech Weekly asked Miles Jacobson, studio director at Sports Interactive, what new features would make someone want to upgrade.
The first thing that people will notice if they've played our previous games is that we have a completely new interface, massively improved match engine, both with the artificial intelligence of the players, but also the 3D view. We've got two new camera angles, well over 100 new animations, and lots of the old animations have been redone as well. The core dev team at SI is 60 people, and we work on three titles, Football Manager, Football Manager Live, and Football Manager Handheld. Some of the components that we develop are used in each of the games, such as the match engine. So everyone is split up into little groups at SI. So we have a match engine team. We have a rule groups team who make sure that all the rules of the leagues are all accurate. We have a media team who also look after the transfers, finance team. And then away from that, we also have a research team, which comprises of 50 head researchers around the world and around 1,500 assistant researchers, and they go and watch footballers play. They're just like football scouts and provide all the stats. We've got over 400,000 players and staff in our database, which is a database that's become so real to real life that Everton Football Club now license our database officially as part of their scouting network, as well as a bunch of other clubs using it unofficially. A bunch of clubs pirating our database, but Everton use it officially. But in an art imitating life, imitating art kind of way, one of our head researchers, a guy in Portugal, has now become chief scout at a team in Portugal as well.
Miles on getting help putting the game together from some well-connected friends.
Ray Houghton, the ex-Liverpool and Republic of Ireland player, he works with us. He used to phone us up when he was working as a scout and an agent and ask us for recommendations of players. A club might have turned round to him and said that they need a left back, they need to be cheap. And I would fax him through a list of players in our database that might be worth looking at. But his job with us is to sit there and watch the match engine. He watches it from a 2D view, from a top-down view, and he'll tell us when players are out of position. So, for example, if there's a throw-in and the right back is 4 pixels out of position, he'll say he shouldn't be standing there, he should be standing there, and then our coders will go away and change that. With the directors of clubs that I speak to, it's more about the finance side of things in the game, making sure that we're getting the transfers side of things right. And an example of that this year, in the game previously, when you're paying for transfers, you can either pay for it all up front or you could spread it across 2 years. But in real life, a lot of clubs spread it across 3- and 4-year payments, and we've added in the 4-year payment possibility.
Miles on what the future does and doesn't hold for Football Manager.
Work has already started on Football Manager 2011, and a couple of the features for that were actually started a good few months ago, because sometimes things take longer than a year. At the moment, we've got between 800 and 900 feature ideas, and last year when we had our features meeting, we actually designated some features for Football Manager 2012 at that meeting, because there's an area that we want to revamp, but we're going to wait until that, because that's when it makes sense. So we plan quite a long way ahead, and you know, we're always looking towards the next game, but it's kind of more what we're not going to be able to do next year rather than what we can do. The one thing we're definitely not going to do, which gets brought up every year in the feature meetings, is that aliens land on the Earth randomly in about 20 years' time and players can then have pace out of 30 instead of out of 20. But that's not going to happen. It's too many people don't like that one. I can't see us having holographic players for a while being beamed into your living room. And I can't see us forcing people to wear 3D glasses when they're playing the game. Because if you don't have the 3D glasses, they look a little bit weird with all the red and green sheen around them.
Miles, on how the hardware might change the Football Manager experience in the future.
We're not really a gamer's game. We don't have people who overclock their PCs to play Football Manager. It's more played by football fans who tend to have slightly older technology. The touch side of things is something I'm really interested in, and I hope it takes off as a technology in a massive, massive way. Because being able to control things through touch and also being able to make your own symbols, to customise your own symbols, to be able to do for instructions, much in the way that with the iPhone you can stretch things out and shrink them in, if you could actually configure that yourself, that would be fascinating. You can do touchline shouts in the game. So if you could actually do those via gesturing, that would be really cool. We're very excited by that technology, but we would need it to be really mainstream before we could spend too much time doing it. And it's one thing with us. We want to be innovators. We want to be the first using technology. But we have to be careful, because if you spend too much time doing that and then the technology doesn't work or it doesn't catch on, you've spent a lot of money and a lot of time doing something that no one cares about. Obviously, Microsoft have Natal coming and Sony have their wand coming or whatever it's going to be called. And those things certainly make consoles a lot more interesting for us, because we're not on consoles at the moment. The joypad control method for our game is awful. We tried with 3 versions and we turned around to Sega, our publisher and now parent company, and said, we don't want to do this anymore, because we didn't want to play our own games at home. So why should any consumer want to play them?
Miles, on how game sales in the run-up to Christmas this year will be quite different.
When you're spending $30, $40 million on making something, you've got to get your return in a financial year, or else your shareholders get annoyed. And that's why so many games are released in the last quarter of the year, you know, Christmas time. This year, however, Modern Warfare 2 is going to take so much money out of people's pockets that a lot of the publishers have moved releases back, particularly for new intellectual property. Because last year there were a few games released at Christmas that didn't do very well that should have done. They were great games, but they were just lost in the shelf space. So we're going to see a very, very busy first 3 months of next year. And I actually think a lot of the games will be better for it, because they'll have had more time spent on them, another few months spent on them to get them right. So it's going to be quite interesting to see whether the previous myth that games wouldn't sell in January, February, March is going to be out of the window.
Miles Jacobson from Sports Interactive there. Miles touched briefly there on how he saw emerging technologies fitting into future releases, but said basically they wanted to wait to see if it caught on. Bobby, you visited EA Games headquarters recently. Did you see evidence of them perhaps showing an earlier commitment to things like gesture-based controls?
No, not really. I think the thing with sports simulations is that you have to get it very, very right, or it fails completely. I think especially with something like Football Manager, which, as he said, is, you know, effectively a statistical simulation rather than a console game, you know, it's going to be very hard to make that useful. Hardcore fans, you know, they want something that works, and that's the main thing.
Do you think games manufacturers are making their annual releases sufficiently different and, you know, expecting people to buy a new copy every year?
I think we're getting to a point now where games are still going up in price. I mean, you know, you buy a new PS3 game and you're not left with that much change out of £100 anymore. And so, you know, everything gets looked at again. And we're in a recession. People don't want to spend as much money. So I think, as Miles said, you know, maybe there's a payoff. The more time that people can spend on a game, the more they can encourage people to buy, and the more features they have to offer. On the other hand, the strange thing about sports games is that actually people don't want it to change too much. If they spent a year playing a game, they buy the next iteration. They don't want it to be radically different because then they have to relearn everything. So there's this kind of weird seesaw going on there that no, you know, it's kind of at a comfortable point at the moment.
In other gaming news, the Tories have announced that they would consider offering tax breaks to the games industry to stop the brain drain. Charles, empty promises, do you think, or a genuine move to help the industry?
Well, the games industry has been lobbying the Labour government over this without much success so far, basically saying that countries such as Canada do have these sorts of tax breaks to encourage games companies to have their headquarters in these places so that they can produce games, which all has an economic boost. If the Tories were to win the election and if they then were to introduce these tax breaks, then that would be effective, certainly. But there's a long way between winning the election and then actually implementing it. I guess there's plenty of time for them to figure out precisely what the tax breaks would be.
I guess we'll have to wait and see. And now it's that time when we look to the blogs and just what your thoughts were this week. Bobby, what's been happening on the games blog?
Well, there's been a lot of interesting discussion. Keith wrote a really good post on the terrorists. What was it, in Modern Warfare 2, I think? The terrorist level that got leaked. But I wanted to actually pick up on something else, which was Greg posted about the Nintendo DS XL, which is effectively a DS with a larger screen, and wondered whether we actually need another iteration of the DS. It's so popular anyway. And Cheradanine said, as someone said on another blog, it's lucky Nintendo aren't in the restaurant business. They'd take the contents of the septic tank, freeze it, paint it pink, call it strawberry ice cream, and charge for it. Which, frankly, was a bit harsh, I thought. I mean, I wouldn't say my DS is the contents of a septic tank, but I see where they're coming from.
Lovely. Now, over at the Digital Content blog, there was a brouhaha about the brouhaha that Stephen Fry caused when he threatened to quit Twitter. As Rubar said, surely this is media eating itself. Invitation to comment on explosive media coverage of a non-story involving a spat between two users of a tool that is dominated by media types. Surely the next story will be breathless coverage of the reaction of Guardian users to this non-event. And by reading that, I believe we have successfully exploded the internet. Although I probably wasn't quite breathless enough. Charles, what's been hot over on the tech blog?
People have been talking about the Orange and iPhone non-price war, of which I think the best comment came from Monkett, who said, seriously, though, disappointing. What annoys me even more than the fact that there's no actual price war is that this pricing policy has spilled across the market, not just affecting the iPhone. So now 24-month contracts are the norm, with a real struggle to find a 12-month contract on a high-end phone. And you don't even get a warranty for the phone that lasts as long as the contract. Good point there.
Mm-hmm. Ouch. Over on Twitter, Wowzer says he enjoyed the scuffle between Charles and Jack last week on Windows 7, so we'll be setting up plenty more combative features in the coming weeks. Whilst on Facebook, Simon Thurston has had to be calmed with a cup of sweet tea with the news that Alex will be making her return, but not until the new year. You can get hold of us on both Facebook and Twitter via the links on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And this week, we've got something special to ask you. We want to see your most ridiculous computing setups. Can you beat Terry Pratchett's 6 monitors? Have you not been able to leave your desk for the past 3 months for fear of toppling that PC tower? Upload your photos to Flickr and then add them to the Guardian Tech Weekly photo group. We'll be highlighting some of the most impressive ones in future shows.
In the Guardian's tech section this week, the first of a 3-part series on the security of computers with Jack Schofield, looking at the problems of keeping PCs safe, seeing how widely malware has spread, and asking what's been done to get rid of it. We wonder if the digital divide can be closed. It looks unlikely if the UK online centres keep closing. Ubuntu and Windows 7 are reviewed, as is Asus's UL30, the ultra-low voltage laptop with a battery life of more than 12 hours. And details of an ambitious plan to plant trees in the desert may not be as pointless as it initially sounds. All this and more in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
So there you have it. All that remains is to thank our wonderful guests, Miles Jacobson and Derek Lomas, as well as Guardian Tech regulars Bobby Johnson and Charles Arthur. Having discussed football management earlier, I think it's only fair to ask you who you'd manage before we go. Charles, your team?
Oh, any group of 11 cats. I like a challenge.
Bobby, who would you take the helm of?
It would have to be my own team, Chelsea, just so I could give Didier Drogba a slap round the face every time he whines.
And I think I'd like to be in charge of Accrington Stanley, purely because of the milk commercials. Join us next week for more tech news, views and reviews. But until next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.